We're looking at illustrations of this law of science that says things go downhill, whereas evolution, of course, says things go uphill, and see which one fits the world we observe better. When we look at the Earth itself, I think we see the principles demonstrated dramatically. When you look at processes as those observed here, is this going uphill or downhill? A very dramatic erosion occurring all over the continents, and we can measure how much of this is going on. You put little instruments in the mouths of the river and you multiply times the volume of flow, the volume of sediment, and what we find is that there's 127.5 billion tons eroded annually into the ocean from the continents every year. Now, 127 billion tons, well, that's kind of hard for us to imagine, but visualize it this way. That's enough to fill a freight train that would reach all the way to the moon and halfway back. Every year, dumped in the ocean. Now, that's not helping the continents a whole lot. But that's been going on for millions of years. Does that make sense? Billions of years. Actually, if it went on for 14 million, we wouldn't have continents. We still got continents, and it's supposed to have been 4.5 billion years since the Earth was formed. Well, you see a problem there. Those ages just don't fit. Obviously, though, this is dramatically going downhill. When we look at the heavens above, I think we see some of the most dramatic examples of this process. And yet, when you hear the astronomer talk, as we mentioned on the radio this afternoon, they talk about galactic evolution, stellar evolution. Everything is going uphill, as cosmic evolution by Chasen we looked at a moment ago. It's all going uphill. But what do we actually see? You go out and look at the heavens in the evening, one of the first things you see are these shooting stars that go zipping by. And if you're a good observer and you observe all night, you can, average observer can observe almost 100 every night. And what are we seeing? We're seeing something that's broken up, come apart, and the pieces are coming down through the atmosphere and burning themselves up, which is an upward process or a downward process? It's coming apart, and it's burning up, and sometimes rather dramatically. This is one of the Linoid meteors. This is one of the larger ones. As it approached the sun, it went around the sun and came back from the sun looking like this. Came apart. It had come apart to form the asteroid, and now then the part came apart. And this is what we're seeing. Many of them will crash into the surface. They're burned up on the Earth usually because of the atmosphere, but without atmosphere, you see here on the surface of the moon, many of them have crashed into it. That's just one less celestial object bashing itself out of existence on the far side, not protected by the Earth. It's really beat up, the other side of the moon. Likewise with Mercury. Wish we had more time to talk about some of the geological features there on Mars. But the thing that you see very dramatically are these craters where things have just bashed the daylights out of them and continue to do it all the time, which is not an uphill process either for the thing bashing or the thing being bashed. We look at comets. They're gorgeous features in the sky. And we see them coming apart, like this Hale-Bopp comet of 97. This is not unusual. Some of the sun grazers are very dramatically coming apart. This is SOHO 6. Notice the statement by NASA. It's a family of comets created by successive breakups from a single large parent comet, which passed very near the sun in the 12th century. This comet, known as SOHO 6, did not survive. It just came apart as it went around the sun. Fred Whipple, one of the leading experts on comets, in his book Mystery of Comets, he's from the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, says comets tend to split in pieces, particularly when they're near the sun or Jupiter, but also when they're quite undisturbed in space. Some comets seem to tire out and die. Does that sound familiar? Where did they come from? There is no process described to bring them into existence. You know, the best explanation, there's this reservoir out here of comets. Where did it come? Well, don't ask me about that. It's just a reservoir. And sometimes something comes by and the perturbations, fancy word says things pass by and wiggle, and they come out and then they start circling the universe and come apart. There's just no explanation at all, but that's what they say. But we see these things coming apart in the sky. This is the string of pearls, as it was sometimes referred to, the Shoemaker-Levy comet that came apart into all of these pieces. NASA put together this dramatization of the pieces as they crashed into Jupiter with the force of many megaton bombs, just boom, 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 bashing the planet and then leaving often this row of bashed holes. Here's a chain of craters. This is on Jupiter's moon Ganymede. Something came apart and then the parts crashed in, boom, 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 leaving this line. Soon after the breakup, the 13 fragments crashed onto Ganymede in rapid succession. Not an uphill process, is it? Likewise on the moon. Here's this chain of craters that illustrate this deteriorative process. Things are coming apart. Just look at the sky. That's what you're looking at. When you look at the sun, what's going on here? Well, there's some question about what's happening and how this is happening, but obviously it is radiating a tremendous amount of energy out into space. It's been estimated about 4.5 million tons per minute are being radiated, consumed, and spread out as energy, not counting the solar prominences, the solar flares that blast tremendous amounts of mass. Here, this prominence compared to Earth, much, much larger, just blasted out into space from time to time. All of that is still not considering the solar wind, which is about another million tons per minute. So we've got a total of about 5.5 million tons per minute radiated out into space. Now, there's a very massive sun there. It's not going to burn out tomorrow, but it's not going to stay this way forever. And obviously, what's happening? It's burning out. Now, that's what we see with our sun. Our sun is like an average-sized star. You multiply that times billions and billions, and what's happening in the universe? It's not uphill. Very dramatically downhill. In the normal, average stellar processes. But then many of them are not average. Many of them just really get excited about going downhill. The planetary nebula are stars that blast about 20 to 30% of their mass out into a shell around it, forming the planetary nebula. NASA says this is the wind from a dying sun-like star producing the planetary nebula, popularly known as the helix. Here's another one that's just blasting itself out of existence, again, not going uphill. Here's the Cat's Eye Nebula, described by NASA as a dying star, throws off shells of glowing gas. Some of them beautiful, the Spirograph Nebula, and a rather geometrical force still spreading out and dissipating. NASA says the ultraviolet radiation floods out into the surrounding gas, causing it to fluoresce. Sometimes people say, oh, it's glowing gas, things are coming together. No, it's the result of the explosion that excites the gas. These fluorescent lights have gas that is excited, that causes it to glow. That's what a fluorescent light is. These are fluorescing because they're next to the explosion and caused to be excited by the explosion. Over the next several thousand years, the nebula will gradually disperse into space. Something blew up, boom, it causes it to fluoresce, and then it disperses. Then the star will cool and fade away. When you look at novas and supernovas, you just multiply that by several million to forces that just blast the star completely out of existence. The one illustrated here was in 87. The picture in the inset on the left is the way the star looked one night. The next night, it looked like the inset on the right. Tens of thousands of times brighter, just blasting itself out of existence. Here's the Crab Nebula, which is an explosion that we know actually observed back in 1054. But NASA describes it as the mess that is left when a star explodes. That's what the Crab Nebula is. This one was observed 1054 by the Chinese, by the Arabs, and by Native Americans. We know what did this. Now, some have suggested maybe a star is forming. No, it's blowing up and fluorescing. The supernova remnants are sometimes very beautiful, but it's the result of a star that has blown up with a blinding flash. The concentrated power equals that of 10 quadrillion suns. Now, the sun is a dissipative force that's burning itself out, but now multiply that by 10 quadrillion? I mean, that's degeneration with a vengeance, isn't it? For a minute or so. And some of them are beautiful, but this is the debris from the explosion of the stars that came apart. Here is the cosmic blast, the scattered debris from a cosmic supernova explosion. It lights up the sky like fireworks. Boom. That's not organizing. That's not forming. That's coming apart and doing so dramatically. Now, one very interesting thing about these supernova remnants is that while we don't understand what triggers them exactly, we have observed that they occur in a regular fashion. And in our galaxy, they appear about every 25 years. And we've seen that now for over 300 years of observation. And about every 25 years, we see another one. This allows us to make some predictions. How many do we see out here? We see one about every 25 years. How many should we see? If the Earth, or if the universe that we're looking at is a million years old, then we ought to see, 40,000 of them? Or a billion years? Now then, they say, well, you won't see 40,000 because there's some clouds out here and some of them have been blown up by other explosions. And they're all kind of secondary assumptions to get rid of the 40,000 that you ought to see. But you just grant everything, all of their exceptions, and you ought to have, according to their estimates, at least 7,000. On the other hand, if we're looking at a universe 7,000 years old, then one every 25 years would give you 280. Maybe you hadn't found all of them yet, and some of them might be behind clouds, so you ought to see something like 270. Okay, now we can make predictions, we can test, we can see which model shares best. How many have we actually observed? So far, we've found 260. Where are the other thousands? I think we're not talking about the age of the Earth or the universe tonight. I'll just throw that in extra. I think that's very interesting. This is from USA Today several years ago. Hubble telescope captures the birth of a star. And you see headlines like this. Okay, a star was formed last night. Wow. Here it is captured. You read the article and it goes on to say it takes hundreds of thousands of years to happen. Obviously, we didn't see it happen last night. What are they talking? Well, it's happening. Well, how do you know it's happening? Well, we see this gas glowing, and that means that the gas is coming together and forming a star. Now, wait a minute. The second law says things get more disorganized. You turn gas loose in this auditorium and it just ordinarily gets more organized, or what happens? Gas spreads out, doesn't it? But you got to explain stars somehow. How do you get them together? Well, this is how. But it looks like they're saying we saw it. You'd have to be seeing for hundreds of thousands of years to have seen it, and you read the fine print before you realize that's what they're talking about. Notice the statement by Landa and Hsu, writing in Science. This is 1990. We have yet to directly observe the process of stellar formation. Nobody has seen that, in spite of what USA Today misleadingly says, even though they correct it as you read further in the article. Nobody has seen this happen, and yet we see in Discover magazine, stellar nurseries. Little stars popping into existence all over the place, and they're talking about the Orion Nebula, which they picture here, and now you've got glowing gases, it must be forming stars. Wait a minute. We know what produces glowing gases. We've observed it. We saw it with the Crab Nebula. Glowing gases. We saw it blow up in 1054. We know
what produces this? And so we look at the Orion Nebula, and well, we didn't see this blow up. This must be coming together. Does that make sense? When we know, look at the smoke from a campfire. What happens? It gets more and more organized. No. It spreads out. This is what we see with the Crab Nebula. It's an explosion. It fluoresces because of that. That's what's going on. No, this must be coming together. Because you've got to get it together somehow, and you've got millions of them out there. NASA describes this as something that will slowly disperse over the next 100,000 years, but you've got stars forming. That just doesn't compute. J.C. Brandt, in his book Sun and Stars, says, contemporary opinion on star formation holds that objects called protostars are formed as condensations from interstellar gas. Gas just says, oops, I think I'm going to get together. And here it comes. Now, the second law says the opposite. And our experience demonstrates that. The laws of physics say that. But no, it's going to condense. You got gravity. And that pulls it together. Okay, you can measure the attractive force of gravity from the mass. And you can also measure the expansive forces that spread gases out. And the expansive forces are 60 times greater than the attractive forces. What's going to happen? That's not hard to figure out. But they've got to get it together somehow. He says this condensation process is very difficult theoretically. In other words, we can't make it work on paper. No essential theoretical understanding can be claimed, but they do in the textbooks. In fact, some theoretical evidence argues strongly against the possibility of, well, it's the second law of thermodynamics. That's not theoretical. That's the fundamental law of science. It's difficult. The laws argue against it. But you just almost feel sorry for him. Abraham Loeb of Harvard says, the truth is we don't understand star formation at a fundamental level. All you got to do is read your high school earth science textbook and they'll tell you all about it. But you talk to the experts and they know they don't know, and the laws of physics say it can't happen the way that it's described in the textbooks. Ward Thompson, writing in the journal Science in 2002, says stars are among the most fundamental building blocks in the universe, yet the process by which they are formed are not understood. Now, your teacher may say otherwise. She's not telling you the truth. They don't know, and they can't make it work on paper. And if you understand the second law of thermodynamics, you understand the problem. Godfrey Bembridge, one of the leading experts in the field, in his book Stellar Structure, says if stars did not exist, it would be very easy to prove that this is what we expect. That's what the physics say. If this has been going on the length of time they're talking about, they should all be gone. Now, all of the people that we're quoting are evolutionists, they're naturalists, they're atheists, every single one of them. I'm going to make one exception and tell you about it when we do. Dr. Mulfinger has a PhD in astronomy from Syracuse, but he is a creationist. But he has evaluated these ideas and says, really, there are only three things wrong with our present view of stellar formation. And he begins with Scripture. Genesis 2 says that the heavens were created and they were finished, and all the host of them. He created them, they were finished. And so his first objection is, it's unscriptural. There are only three problems. First, it's unscriptural. Second, it's never been observed. And third, it's theoretically impossible. But aside from those three problems, he says, it's a real winner. You think stars are a problem? Galaxies are assemblages of hundreds of billions of stars. You can't explain the star getting together. How do you explain the hundreds of billions of stars themselves getting together as an assemblage? Martin Rees is an atheist, astrophysicist, but says the most basic questions about galaxies are still not understood. If galaxies didn't exist, we'd have no problem explaining that fact. Sounds like a refrain, doesn't it? An echo that we've heard. And yet you get the impression they can explain all of this, and they can't explain any of this by their own statements. We look at some of the spiral galaxies, just spectacular. And what's causing the spiral? Well, these things are winding themselves up. If you understand Kepler's third law, maybe you don't know it is that, but you watch the ice skater and they hold their arms out and they slow down, they pull their arms in and they speed up. The inside of this, inside, is spinning faster than the outside. And when that happens, it's going to wind itself up, isn't it? So just a few turns and this thing wouldn't look like this. And it's going fairly fast, certainly in terms of the 10 to 12 billion years that are supposed to be the age of the universe. And it's pretty well defined. Notice the statement here in Sky and Telescope. This was from 2005, December. Spiral-shaped wave patterns from the galaxy's center whirl around core three times as often as those 6,000 light years out. So the center is going much faster, all but guaranteeing the galaxy's bright inner pinwheel is destined to wind itself up into an amorphous disk. And they go on to say this happens very rapidly, but there's a lot of them out there that are not wound up, that just say, I have not been here very long, if you just listen to what they're saying. And worse than that are the barge spirals. Notice the bar right here in the center. This thing hasn't turned once. If it did, that bar would not be there. But it's supposed to have been there billions of years, and it's spinning much faster in the center. What it's saying to those who say it's been here for billions of years is, nah, 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 nah. You can't explain this. It's just making fun of them. And they're beautiful barred spirals. It has these tails around it, but that bar is saying, no, this has not been here very... It's like it was created yesterday, just like this. Here's the M83 barred spiral, and they're all over the place. Beautiful. Just spectacular, and I think making fun of the idea that they've been up there spinning for years. It's impossible. More recently, we've been able to look with the Hubble telescope deep, deep into space, and according to their theoretical concepts, back to the beginning of the Big Bang, because we can see much further now. And here from the Dallas Morning News, we're told astronomers at the Space Telescope Science Institute released the deepest ever view of the universe. Now, if we look back to the beginning, we should see the baby galaxies. And when stars hadn't formed galaxies and just maybe beginning to start to get together, the immature baby galaxies is what we ought to see. Here is a look just a few hundred million years from the Big Bang. It's supposed to have been there for 12, 13 billion. And what are we seeing? We're seeing perfectly mature galaxies, exactly what we see in all directions. There's no baby galaxies. There's nothing immature. As you go back to the beginning, they look just like they do everywhere else. A wide range of galaxies in different sizes and shapes and colors. And here from the Gemini Observatory, they're describing that problem. Why do galaxies in the young universe appear so mature? Right back to the beginning, and they look just as massive and just as well-formed and defined and pinwheel-shaped as they do anywhere else. They shouldn't. But they do. And why? They don't have an answer. Richard Cowan, University of California at Davis, says galaxy formation theory is in peril because of this. Over the past 18 months, several teams have found so many massive galaxies from this early epoch that the theory is beginning to be stretched to its breaking point. So, in other words, we're not ready to turn loose yet, but we don't have an answer. Notice the observations of James Trefel, who's professor of physics at George Mason University. He says, it seems the more we learn about the basic laws of nature, he's not talking about Sunday school lessons here, the basic laws of nature, the more the laws seem to tell us that the visible matter, the stuff we can see, shouldn't be arranged the way it is, because it's all organized. Not only do we see stars organized, we see galaxies, which are organizations of stars, we see organizations of galaxies, and then we see even greater structures, walls across the universe. it shouldn't be arranged the way it is because the laws of physics says it ought to be coming apart. He says there shouldn't be galaxies out there at all, according to just the plain laws of physics. And even if there are galaxies, they shouldn't be grouped together. Stars bad enough, but then groups of stars, then groups of stars multiply the problem. Here's the galaxy cluster, Abel 2118 and Draco, the Hercules cluster of galaxies. Each galaxy, hundreds of billions, you grasp that? Hundreds of billions of stars that are together organized. And now then we've got those hundreds of billions of stars themselves organized with other hundreds of billions of organized stars. And it's just all out there making fun of those who try to explain this naturally in the face of the second law of thermodynamics. It's just a mockery of the laws of physics, the way they explain it. We look at the universe, which we're interested in, and we look at the earth science textbooks, and it says all of this came about as the condensation from this nebular hypothesis. You got this nebular gas, and it all circled around, and these planets condensed out of it, and now we got the solar system, just naturally. All kinds of problems with that idea. First, the sun, right in the center, has 99% of the mass of the universe. That's just almost all of it relative to the rest of the universe, of the solar system. The planets, though, have 99% of the angular momentum. The sun's not doing a whole lot of moving, but the planets are just zipping along like crazy. But it all condensed out of the same cloud. Now, if you know anything about physics, there's no way to separate the mass from the angular momentum. It just is just impossible to do that, which they have acknowledged. They just say this is a problem. Here is the slow spin. Here is the rapid orbital motion, all condensing out of the same cloud. And some of it's going this way. Some of the planets are going this way. Some of them going that way. Retrograde motion. George Jeffries of Cambridge, for these reasons, says, I think all the suggested accounts of the origin of the solar system are subject to serious objections. The conclusion in the present state of the subject would be the system cannot exist. I hear that echo. You know, we can't explain this is another way to say that. And various parts of the solar system demonstrate the same kind of problem regarding the moon, and we've learned a lot about the moon. But here from nature, we read many models have been proposed for the formation of the moon, but no one has succeeded in showing the formation satisfactorily. You can't make it fit what we observe. We could spend a whole evening lecturing on that point. Lasseter, again from nature, says, all in all, developing a theory of lunar origins that could make sense of the data proved very difficult. The best explanation was observational error. The moon did not exist. If you're going to be a physicist consistent with the law, you can't make it work. Now, we're told these fellows can explain these things, but we read if stars did not exist, that's what we expect. If there shouldn't be galaxies, they shouldn't be grouped. Solar system can't exist. The best explanation of the moon, it doesn't exist. What can these fellows explain? Without God, you can't. The natural processes will not explain what we see. It takes supernatural processes to explain what's being seen out there. Now, as we evaluate the two models, creation and evolution, which model explains best? The creation model says things are created, then there is a curse placed on the universe, things degenerate down to dust. We predict that there's going to be degeneration. The evolutionist says everything's going to go uphill, and he teaches and believes devoutly it is, but what do we see? When we look at the world we live in, we know things go downhill, don't we? Our bodies, our houses, everything we experience goes downhill. When we look at the life of the past, we look at those cattails 120 feet tall, and we look at the horses 9 feet tall at the shoulder. The armadillo is 9 times as large. Which model fits best? When we look at the universe around us very dramatically, everything is going downhill and burning up and blowing up and just saying, na 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 na. It's not going to be explained naturally. Which model serves best? That's the question. And I think if you're a real scientist and follow the evidence, the answer is just as obvious as it can be.
Back to Isaac Asimov as we conclude this evening. He summarizes regarding the second law of thermodynamics, saying, as far as we know, all changes are in the direction of increasing entropy or increasing disorder. Which answers the last slide, you know, which model fits best. Of increasing randomness, of running down. Yet, and here's the real question, and he's facing it. Yet the universe was once in a position from which it could run down for trillions of years.
How did it get into that position? It didn't get there naturally because the natural processes go the other way. How did it get up here? It had to be supernatural. There's just no other honest conclusion.
And some of the physicists just butt their heads against that and face it. Here is Lipsom writing in the physics bulletin saying, I think, however, we should go further than that, than this, and admit the only accepted explanation is creation. That's the only way you can get things up so they could run down. I know this is anathema to physicists, as it is to me. I mean, he's an atheist. He hates this. But we must not reject the theory we do not like if the experimental evidence supports it. And he says this is not because of the Sunday school lessons. This is because of the facts of physics. I hate it, but there it is. And there's no way around it. Now, that's what we need to be willing to defend and to demonstrate. We'll conclude with one more statement from Weiland and Sontag. These are two very brave men. These are the authors of the textbook that's used in almost every university in the country to teach thermodynamics. Every state university in Texas, I know, uses this textbook. Now, maybe you can say, all right, you're a geologist, an archaeologist, but you don't really understand thermodynamics. It takes an engineer. Maybe that's right. These fellows wrote the book. They do understand. We see the second law of thermodynamics as a description of the prior and continuing work of a creator. That's what it necessarily implies. That's not a geologist's conclusion. This is one who wrote the book on thermodynamics. The creator who holds the answer to our future destiny and that of the universe. That's what the laws of physics say. And if we're honest, that's what we're going to have to face. When you face the Lord in judgment and you are faced with the fact you heard tonight, evidence presented that says there's no escaping the conclusion, God is. And what's your answer going to be if you don't obey? We want to extend his invitation this evening and encourage you to do just what he tells you to do in his divine book. Come confessing your faith in Christ, repenting of your sins, and being baptized into Christ. God said that in his book that describes the beginning of this universe accurately. And you'll give an account for how you dealt with this information on the day of judgment. Won't you come and prepare yourself for that great day, which is certainly coming. If you've wandered away, come back. Make things right while we stand together and sing.